This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll talk with the versatile Jennifer Hannon. She loves being Jewish, and one of the ways she expresses it is through her passion for her eternal homeland, Israel. And she also is prominent on fertility issues. And we'll discuss, when you can't get pregnant, what do you do? Also, American Exodus is the book from Giles Slade, Climate Change and the Coming Flight for Survival. Giles Slade on why some scientists predict the sea will rise 1.5 meters before 2100. And this could continue a pattern of migration to Canada. We'll talk with him about American Exodus. And the incomparable Dean Koontz, back with another New York Times number one bestseller, Innocence. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Jennifer Hannon. She loves being Jewish, and one of the ways she expresses it is through her passion for her eternal homeland, Israel. She's a founder and executive director of the digital advocacy group Act for Israel, and besides her passion for Israel and its people, Jennifer is an award-winning writer, influential blogger, freelance journalist, and co-author of What to Do When You Can't Get Pregnant, the complete guide to all the technologies for couples facing fertility problems. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. You're a person of many talents and interests, and let's start with the fertility issue.
Okay.
Since you first wrote this book, there have been obviously some developments. How is it for people who are having difficulty having children?
Well, it's hard. I think most people, especially women now, to wait till they're in their later 20s, sometimes early 30s, to start thinking about a family. In my case, I was in my second marriage, and I was in my mid-30s, and my good friend, who is in D.C., kind of convinced me that all of her friends that are in their second marriages that are having problems getting pregnant. And so I kind of took that to heart, and my husband and I had been married. I would say we've been together and married at least 2 years, and so we started looking just to be on the safe side. And I come from a family of, I've got two brothers and a sister, so I didn't think I'd have problems, but I knew my only sister had some issues with fertility. So that made me look, and I found a great doctor, Dr. Potter, with HRC Fertility. It used to be Huntington Reproductive Centers when I was a patient, but he is excellent. He's a top doctor, and he really cared about the fact that we wanted to get pregnant.
Jennifer Hannon is our guest, and many couples face this. And at a certain age, women used to be and perhaps still are warned against possible birth defects and things like that. Is that still a consideration?
It is, and there are plenty of things that you can do to prevent that. One of them is to go through testing. There is something called pre-implantation genetic screening, which is PGS, which you can ask your fertility specialist about, either your OB or if you have a fertility specialist like Dr. Potter. You can ask them about that testing. The other one is PGD, which is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. It is not a diagnostic test. This is also a screening test. Both look at chromosome abnormalities and look at the chromosome to make sure that when you go into IVF, you're actually implanting eggs and sperm and fertilizing those that are the very best of what you have. So you can make sure that, you know, or at least, I don't want to say make sure, there's no guarantee for anything in life, but at least it helps you have a better and a greater chance of getting pregnant.
As far as fertility treatments, at what point does it become unrealistic, or does it ever, for a woman to have these treatments?
Well, I'd hate to say it does, but we know biologically it does. Women are only born with so many eggs, and those eggs, the quality diminishes as they age, and same goes for sperm in men. So I would say, you know, if you're getting up to 40, you're probably starting to get worried if you don't have a mate or if you don't have a baby. You're probably thinking in your 30s, if you don't have a mate, you need to find one, and you need to probably look at that. I think one of the misnomers is that a lot of men don't really feel like they need to go in. A lot of men avoid the dentist and the doctor, so naturally they would avoid the reproductive specialist. They don't have to see one. They can also see a urologist. They can see a urologist or a reproductive endocrinologist. That's what Dr. Potter is. Would I suggest they go in earlier? Yes. And the simple fact is you don't want to wait too long.
Now, we have a former governor here in Louisiana, Edwin Edwards, who just had a child. His wife did. He's 86. She's 35. You say when a man reaches a certain age, it becomes an issue as well.
Well, I think Hugh Hefner and people like that kind of point out that you know, men can be as old as they want to be and still be fertile. I think the main thing is just to be checked out, because you might find that any man could have slow sperm, which is basically the motility, the speed of the sperm is not fast enough, or the morphology, the chromosomal makeup of the sperm may not be 100%. And so, you know, by going into the doctor to have those tests done early on, you might save yourself thousands of dollars. I've known people and interviewed people who have gone through it six times, and you can imagine they spent well over $100,000 just trying to get pregnant, and they may not even know that there's an issue on both sides.
Well, what about the cost? You mentioned that, that there's certainly a cost that is such that some people may not be able to do this.
Right. Well, some companies, really leading companies, top companies, offer some type of insurance that does cover some fertility treatment. So you want to check with your company first. I would assume you're employed if you're going to go down the IVF or the fertility pathway. So you want to check with that first, check with your insurance first. If they don't, some clinics like HRC Fertility does offer financing in some cases, so you want to look and see if your specialist offers financing. That helps tremendously. I know we probably use that because it is expensive. And, of course, the more cycles you do, the greater the cost is. Some clinics HRC, when I went through, did offer specials, like you could do maybe more than one cycle, you know, and pay X amount. But they have creative type of financing plans. So if you're not even sure that, you know, maybe you've had a miscarriage or two, you might offer a plan like that, where if you had to go through a second cycle, you could, and you paid for it, you know, in one time period or over time. So there's all those options available. But in our book, we actually discuss financing, and we discuss states and the new insurance laws and things like that. And so you want to look into all those things before you invest all your time, money, and energy into something that may or may not work for you.
We're visiting with Jennifer Hannon. She was ranked as the 38th of 100 most influential Jewish Twitter users a few years ago, and number 10 in the category of politics and policy. How did you get immersed in this particular issue?
Well, actually, I converted in 2008, and I was interested in Judaism probably since I was a kid, but more like in my 20s and growing up. And so when I started, I was working on a book with another doctor, and that book wasn't getting picked up. So my publicist, or really my literary agent at the time, asked me. We had a discussion about what do you want to write about, and I had a couple ideas, but I said, "But I really want to write about becoming Jewish." And she said, "Well, you know, I have the person for you." And so she connected me with a rabbi, and we talked, and we were on the same page, and decided to write about it. But I guess the backstory to that is that my literary agent said, "You know what? To really promote your book, you need to get online. You need to get into Facebook. You need to get on Twitter. You need to get out there. You need to get your voice out there." So I tried to pick an issue that I felt was really important, like mm-hmm. the Middle East, and write about something that was dear to me. And so I started to write about it, and some great people from Israel actually contacted me and said, "Would you like to start an organization?" And that's how it got started.
And how substantial is the organization now?
Well, the organization had some issues for years, for at least 3 years. We were trying to get a 501c3, and we tried and we tried and we tried, and we pretty much did it, well, we did it all on no funds at all. So for about 3 years, we were blogging and sending things out and trying to make things happen, and that 501c never got approved. And so at some point, we finally just said, you know, we can't do this forever for free. And so as much as we wanted to do it, we kind of all went our separate ways to advocate, but we really... I can't say we are actively immersed in the group we were in because of the financing issue.
What do you think the biggest challenge Israel faces today is?
Today, I think it's acceptance. I think that acknowledgement, you know, is number one. And I think the huge issue is the refugee issue, because if you look at Senator Mark Kirk's bill, the one that Daniel Pipes and Stephen Rosen worked on, they actually, you know, promoted that bill. If we don't count the number of real residents, of real Palestinians, and when I say real, I mean the ones that were actually were in 48 when Israel made its independence, if we don't look at that, then there's always going to be a problem. But if we can actually count the real number of refugees and not their children and not their grandchildren and not their great-grandchildren, we might actually have a chance of having a real Palestinian state, you know, next to a real Israel. So I think it's really about numbers at this point.
Well, Jennifer's most recent book is Becoming Jewish, The Challenges, Rewards, and Paths to Conversion. Now, your path was such that your background was as a Christian?
Yes, I grew up as a Catholic.
And what prompted the conversion to Judaism?
Well, I was married already. My husband and I married in Arizona in a non-denominational wedding. In fact, the woman that married us was a rabbi, and she actually converted to, I think, a Unitarian church. So it was a non-denominational wedding because my church wouldn't accept, you know, our union with Adam as Jewish, and the Jewish faith wouldn't accept me as a Catholic. So we were in a non-denominational wedding. But what spurred me on was really I had a friend from my kid's preschool that asked me to go to a puppet show at a synagogue. And when I went, I just fell in love with it. And we went back every Friday, every Shabbat, and we participated and made good friends. And within a few months, even with the Christmas tree up and lights in the house and a Santa, you know, decoration, huge one in the yard, I told my rabbi, I said I wanted to, you know, our rabbis at the synagogue, I want to convert. And so we talked about it, and I didn't actually convert until the next August, because when you convert, you have to go in the calendar year, and that's when all the Jewish holidays start in September.
Do you still put up a Christmas tree?
You know what? This is the first year we've actually put one up since then. We didn't put one up for many, many years, and I found that that my family and my husband's family, my family weren't really getting together anymore. We used to get together for the holidays, the December holidays. It was both holidays, and we kind of just like lost touch with each other. So we decided this year to put one up, and in hopes that we can actually all get together again. So,
well, how turbulent is the Middle East right now, Jennifer?
I would say it's fairly turbulent. I mean, I would say that you know, Israel can count probably its friends on its finger, or on its hand, one hand, who its real friends are. And I would say that probably, you know, it's going to take all the Middle East countries to agree that you know, there are a number of majority Islamic states. There's only one Jewish state. And so if you look at the numbers, you can kind of see that, wow, that's pretty huge. You know, one Jewish state and then, you know, I think in the IOC alone, we have, there's got to be 57 states, right? Mm-hmm. Majority Muslim states. So 57-1, that's really quite big. There should be at least one Jewish state, I think.
Is this friction with Iran? Is this a powder keg that is ready to blow?
Well, probably. I mean, you think about it. Iran has many, many states, and Iran basically is, for the most part, it's not the people. We like the people there, but the leaders are, from what I understand, are state supporters of terror all around the world. So you look at Lebanon, you look at Syria, you look at all the friction in the Middle East, you look at the states that are helping, you know, promote terror. It's pretty big.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. A fascinating lady, Jennifer Hannon, who has written books about, you talk about varied topics, but on both of them quite compelling. What to Do When You Can't Get Pregnant, The Complete Guide to All the Technologies for Couples Facing Fertility, and Becoming Jewish, The Challenges, Rewards, and Paths to Conversion. Coming next is Giles Slade, a Canadian freelance writer and social critic. His book is American Exodus: Climate Change and the Coming Flight for Survival. We'll talk with Giles Slade about the environmental issues which affect us all, and he says that are reaching a tipping point. Also later in the show, Dean Kuntz, the remarkable writer, back with another number one New York Times bestseller. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest is Giles Slade. He's a Canadian freelance writer, a social critic, best known as author of Made to Break, Technology and Obsolescence in America. Born in Ottawa, and a man who has followed the environment for some time, his latest work is American Exodus, Climate Change and the Coming Flight for Survival. The Coming Flight for Survival. Good morning, Giles Slade.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Some scientists predict the sea will rise 1.5 meters before 2100. What does this mean?
I think it means a whole lot more storm surges like you had during Hurricane Katrina, which is bad news, I guess, if you're living in Louisiana.
Are we allowing this to happen without taking the precautions, the actions that are necessary to stop it?
Well, I think that's been going on for about 20 years. We really haven't done anything to stop it, to mitigate global warming, and so now we have to figure out what we're going to do when the worst of it hits us.
When I mentioned that 1.5 meters the sea will rise before 2100, there are some who predict it could be even worse.
Yeah, that's that 1.5 is a very conservative estimate, and that's really one of the problems. Nobody really wants to look at exactly how bad it might get, because that's very expensive and very alarming. So the most conservative estimate seems to be the one that gets published, and people look at that and think, oh, well, that's not really so bad. But even a meter and a half, I mean, that's quite a bit of water.
Giles Slade says in the coming century, intensifying storms will batter our coasts, and there will be droughts of magnificent proportion, and heat events will become annual threats. For those of us alive in 2013, do we really, or should we really care about what happens in 2113?
I think it's going to happen a bit sooner than that. I think within the next 20 to 30 years, there's going to be a radical tipping point in North America's climate, and so people's children and grandchildren are going to be involved, and that's really why we have to worry about it. Where I am is a small town south of Vancouver, Canada, and we're right at sea level. And so I think, you know, in a very short time, within 10 years, you know, it's going to affect all the houses in the neighborhoods in which I live, you know. So it's a really serious problem. Superstorm Sandy, you know, when it rocked Manhattan last year, it caused $80 billion worth of damage. And this kind of thing is going to happen again and again, going to happen more and more frequently. And, of course, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Florida coasts are very vulnerable to exactly this kind of thing, storms and sea level surges. But there's also the drought across the south, which is driving people out of the southern states, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico. There's a lot of things happening, and it's too big and too late to mitigate, so people are going to have to consider moving.
So what would happen, Giles, if the U.S. cannot provide food or fresh water for people in these large American cities where 80% of Americans currently reside?
Well, imagine, you know, what happened during the Dust Bowl, you know, only on a much grander scale. 2.5 million people left the Great Plains during the 30s because there wasn't any water there. And since 1982, there was a sort of economic collapse in Mexico in 1982, and it's been continuing ever since, which is, you know, I don't mean to laugh about it, but I mean, it's a disaster if you're Mexican. At the same time, that kind of an economic crisis creates an environmental crisis because people go back to sort of subsistence farming. And the northern states of Mexico were heating up at the time, so it was very hard to grow anything, certainly enough things to eat. So they poured into the United States looking for jobs and work and money and sent back the money to their families and friends in Mexico. And now 25 million Mexicans that we know of, you know, live, eat, work, and sleep in the United States every day. So it's had this kind of radical effect already on Mexico, and the same thing's going to happen in America. And the way I feel about it is the toothpaste is being squeezed through North America's tube, and it's kind of reached the middle of North America, but the squeezing is going to keep happening, and eventually the toothpaste is going to come north.
In a cautionary tale, American Exodus, Climate Change, and the Coming Flight for Survival, Giles Slade argues that we're entering a long period of global desperation, which will be characterized by human migration on an unprecedented scale. So where will these people go?
Anywhere they can, really, and anywhere where the quality of life appears to be better. You I talked to a fellow who was in downtown New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit. He was 19 years old at the time. His name is Jabbar Gibson, and he's now in a federal prison in northern Louisiana. The Pollock Security Unit Center, I think it's called. Pollock Camp Unit 1. But Jabbar, he was 19 years old, and all his family and friends didn't have access to cars. So he stole a school bus, and he drove them to the Astrodome. Really rescued, 70 people. And it's kind of a heroic tale, but, when you're in that kind of desperate situation, you do anything you can, and you go any place that looks better. And so he drove to Texas. But people along the coast, the eastern coast of the United States, people in the Southwest, will look north because there's going to be a lot more water in the north, and it's going to be a lot cooler.
Well, so yeah, because of the change involving the drought, you say that lands above the 49th parallel will become more compelling.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's only 35 million Canadians occupying the second largest country in the world. So we can expect a whole lot more company, and there's 350 million of you. So 1% comes here, that's 3.5 million people, and really that's too big for us to handle, so we need to start planning for this now.
Giles Slade is our guest. He is an award-winning author of Made to Break and The Big Disconnect. You call yourself a recovering academic. What does that mean?
That means I got over teaching at university about 10 years ago and decided that I really didn't want to do it for the rest of my life and just became an independent writer, which is what I meant to do all along. I just had to find a way to pay for it.
Well, a few days ago on this show, Giles, we had an author who suggested that Canada and the United States should become one. Based on what you're telling us regarding the environment, it sounds like that might be a good deal for the U.S.
A very good deal for the U.S. I think any way you look at it, it would be a wonderful deal for the U.S. because we're sort of resource rich at a time when the rest of the world has no resources or is running out of resources. You'll encounter a lot of resistance from Canadians, I think, who there's about 20 or 30% of Canadians who have this kind of knee-jerk anti-Americanism, but really, I think things are getting so bad, we ought to sit down and negotiate and have this conversation while we still can and while it will still be a reasonable conversation. Yeah.
Now we see events like Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy, and some of us attribute that at least partially to global warming and environmental mishaps that humans have contributed to. But you note that this phenomenon of urban heat, which you say is going to get worse, it is, as far as when you count the numbers, it is a more deadly phenomenon than floods and hurricanes.
Yeah, it happens, I guess, with greater regularity, and it will increase. There was a heat wave in Europe in the first decade of this new millennium that we've got, and it killed they don't even know how many people it killed, but somewhere between 30,000 and 50,000 people across France, Germany, Russia, Italy, and that's the kind of thing that you can expect if we approach heat waves unprepared. Chicago had a massive heat wave in the same decade, and it caused, I think, about 1,000 deaths, 900 to 1,000 deaths, which is much more than, what hurricanes or drownings do every year. And these kinds of heat waves, because the planet's heating up and because the regional climates are changing, these kind of heat waves are just going to get longer and more intense. And that means that, a concrete city is just going to bake, retain the heat, and be really unlivable for, now it's unlivable for 2-3 weeks, but, a month, 2 months, 3 months, depending on what part of the century you're in. So really, our cities are becoming much less habitable at the same time that maybe they're drying out and water supplies are becoming much more difficult to feed into the city. So cities themselves, large, really urban centers, are a kind of obsolete notion, and we need to move back to smaller communities.
What happens to places like New Orleans and Baton Rouge and Houston and Atlanta in the next 20 to 50 years?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, but, I'm just trying to sort of plot the trends. And the reason I'm trying to do it is because I have three sons. And, I'm really concerned. I'm 60 now. I'm really concerned about what their life's going to be like after I check out. So I think they're going to become, Mr. Friedman says, hot, flat, and crowded. They're going to become much more unpleasant places to live. The infrastructure is going to be repaired less. The water supplies are going to become more impure and less frequent. The electricity grid that feeds them won't be able to maintain, air conditioning in the summer, so the heat waves will be more intense and more alarming. And they will be unpleasant places to live at the very best. And people will look around and see that, the quality of life elsewhere is still pretty good. And that will motivate, I guess, some people to move before there is a crisis, and then many more people to move when the first, second, or third crisis happens. So if, Superstorm Sandy is followed by, a few more superstorms that hit the east coast of the United States, a lot more people will consider moving, especially since they won't be able to get insurance for, property insurance for, or business insurance for anything located, close to an ocean. And that, single economic effect will affect people profoundly, and they'll move.
Where should we go? If, let's say, somebody's 40 years old and planning on retiring in 20 or 25, maybe 30 years, and hoping to live a life of leisure, you're telling us that there may not be any more leisure nor life in some areas. So where do we go?
Well, for me, British Columbia seems like a really obvious choice simply because. And, of course, British Columbia is immediately north of Washington and Oregon states. It's on the western coast of Canada, simply because water is going to be the new gold in the extreme, weather conditions of the new century. And the coast of North America, and especially the northernmost coast of North America, will enjoy 30 to 40% more water because this hot air sort of sweeping across the Pacific sucks up more water and then dumps it when it hits the mountains of the coast. And so we're going to be very water rich. It's going to be very rainy. So if you like sunny weather, that's too bad. But it's going to be one of the most comfortable places to live.
Well, reflecting back to Katrina, and you write about it in your book, American Exodus, you say it, you note a researcher 23 days before Katrina's arrival as a Category 5 storm, wrote that it's the potential destructiveness of hurricanes increased markedly since the mid-1970s. Longer storm lifetimes and greater storm intensity suggest that future warming may lead to an upward trend in tropical cyclone destructive potential, and taking into account an increasing coastal population, a substantial increase in hurricane-related losses in the 21st century. This account appeared in Nature on July 31st, 2005.
Right, right. And nobody noticed it, certainly, not any city officials. But there was, in New Orleans local paper, there have been, a series of articles about the destructive potential of the coming hurricane. And I think there was a large evacuation because of those series of articles. Mark Schlefstein, I think, wrote it, was one of the authors. And so the horrible destruction that had been predicted didn't actually occur. There weren't the grand number of deaths that were supposed to have happened because people evacuated. People had been warned. What I'm worried about is, like my friend Jabbar Gibson, poor people who are left in the inner city who don't have access to cars can't get out. Okay, there's been no provision to get them out. So they're the ones who suffer the most, and so we need to plan for that. I think Chicago did a really good job planning for heat waves. They established, you know, cooling stations throughout the city, and they targeted old people and people who lived alone. We can do the same thing for storm surges. And in fact, in Bangladesh, after a devastating hurricane in the last century, they established this kind of a corps of policemen, you know, sort of Paul Revere's, who ride around on bicycles and blow whistles, warning everybody that there's a storm surge coming and that they should get out. People collect in public spaces and then they're bussed out in school buses. This kind of thing could be organized very easily and wouldn't cost very much.
Giles Slade is the guest for a few more moments. His book is American Exodus. Clive Hamilton, the author of Earth Masters, The Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering, says holding this book should feel like the touch of a cattle prod. But most of us have hides too thick to feel the shock, and we will need several more of ever higher voltage before we heed its message. For those with thinner skins, read it and be prepared. So when does this start happening to the point where people say, look, I just can't handle this anymore, I'm out of here, I'm going to Canada? When does this happen?
Oh, I think it's already happening. Our American immigration is spiking a bit. We're at 12,000 people, which for Canada is huge. Canada has a population of 35 million, and our maximum immigration so far has been 400,000. Now we're up to 12,000 Americans a year coming here for citizenship, and about 35,000 Americans coming for work visas. And so there are about 1 million Americans now living in Canada, 1/35th of our entire population. They're the fourth largest immigration group that we have after Filipinos, Chinese, and Indians. During the entire Vietnam War, 1958 and 1975, only 500,000 Americans came here. It was 200,000, I think, draft dodgers and deserters, and then 300,000 friends, family, and fellow travelers. But they had a massive impact on our country. And so this current wave, which is just, you know, right now just a trickle, this current wave is going to have a really, really important impact on Canada. Canada is going to become, you know, America North, I think. And so I think the early adopters have already started coming here. And, after the next superstorm, there'll be more. And after each successive disaster, there'll be even more.
Well, thank you, Giles Slade. The book is American Exodus, Climate Change, and the Coming Flight for Survival. You're certainly a provocative guest, and we look forward to a future discussion with you as we evolve as a world. Who knows, the world's going to change in a big way if you're right, and it's going to change relatively soon.
It'll be wrong.
Thank you, Giles.
Thank you.
Take care. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is the incomparable Dean Koontz, with over 450 million books in print. Dean has been one of the world's most iconic writers. His capacity to interweave themes of love and suspense and mystery and fantasy are unparalleled. And nowhere is his talent more evident than in his latest work, Innocence, a novel that defies classification, equal parts heart-wrenching romance, urban fantasy, and supernatural epic. Innocence is the entry point into the Koontz canon. Good morning, Dean Koontz.
Good morning.
You've been doing this for a few years, and we have talked before, and you do it over and over, and it seems like you never lose your zest or your ability to unearth new dimensions of the human psyche.
Well, it's the one thing I know how to do, Jim, so I have to try to do it the best I can, or otherwise I'm out in the cold. So it was my dream for almost from childhood to be a writer, so it's amazing to me that it actually came to bear fruit.
Well, he in innocence, lives in solitude beneath the city, an exile from society which will destroy him if he is ever seen, and she dwells in seclusion, fugitive from enemies who will do her harm if she is ever found. This bond is the thread that runs through innocence.
Yes, Addison, the lead who narrates the story, was on the night he was born, the midwife who delivered him in the isolated home high in a remote mountain tried to kill him because his appearance so repulsed her. And his mother, when he's eight, says, "I can't bear to look at you anymore," and turns him out. So Addison ends up living in a city, but underneath it, secretly, in subway tunnels and storm drains, and moves about the city and knows all the secret entrances to places. And one night in the library, he meets a girl. It's at 3 a.m, and the place is closed. And this girl is, in some ways, just as strange as he is. She has social phobia and can't bear to be touched or approached too closely, and he is repellent to look at because everyone who looks at him either tries to kill him or flees. And a bond develops between them, and the story is about the two of them. And it's a little bit Beauty the Beast, a little bit Phantom of the Opera, but a totally own thing, suspense and love story. I try to mix it up because I bore easily when I'm sitting at the keyboard.
You're a man of great faith. Does that influence your writing?
Well, it has to. I see life as having meaning and purpose, and the world as being a place of deep mystery. And when you see the world that way, it's bound to infiltrate your work. And my books tend to be hopeful. Some people think, oh, they're very scary. Well, scary isn't the only thing I do, and it's not even necessarily the central thing I do. I'm really writing stories about suspense novels that are about hope, which may seem a strange combination, but in my case, it's the only thing I can do.
Well, you have a record that is almost unparalleled, one of 12 writers to have achieved a milestone with 14 number one New York Times hardcover bestsellers. Does this create any kind of undue pressure, or does it really matter?
Well, you know, when you're first starting out and you have your first bestseller, it matters. It's exciting. And after an amount of time, it matters because you want to keep your audience. And you got into this because you want to reach out to people. And so it's always important that you be there. But less and less as time goes by, you're just grateful that people still want to read what you do.
Do you think you write in a way that nobody else does? You know, I guess we're all unique, but there are some who are such that there's really nobody who compares with Dean Koontz.
Well, that's not much for me to say. I think that what I always say to young writers is the worst you can do is listen to criticisms of your style. If somebody wants to criticize your plot or your characterization or something, that's one thing. But your style is your voice. It's what's unique to you. And if you listen to criticism, you're going to pollute the criticism of your style. You're going to pollute that very thing that is what you most have to sell. So I just write the way I write and hope that people like it. And fortunately, they do.
And you keep doing it over and over. What's the time frame as far as putting out one book after the other?
Well, one of the spooky things about this is you have a deadline and you start writing a book, and I never know how long it's going to be. Is it going to be 300 manuscript pages, 400, 500, 600? And as I'm approaching that that delivery date, I'm always breaking into a sweat now and then. But it takes me anywhere from 4 to 6 months to write a novel, but then I'm in here at 7 a.m. until dinner, and I always eat breakfast at my desk, and I never eat lunch because it makes me kind of slappy-minded. And so when you put in those kind of hours of 6 days a week, the pages do mount up.
Your first bestseller, Demon Seed, that was, what, around 1977? So you were just past 30 years old when you knew that your world was changing. How did the acclaim as a writer change you in any way?
Well, there's something I always say to young writers is read your reviews if you want, but don't pay any attention to either the negative or the positive, because both can corrupt you. I've known writers who are, I've greatly admired, who struggled a long time in their careers and suddenly became overnight successes, overnight in quote marks, because they'd been working decades till they got there. And then the reviewers focus on certain strengths, but don't always recognize all the strengths. And I've seen writers suddenly begin to write toward the reviewer and give up some of the stronger things in their work in order to satisfy what the critics like, and you don't want to do that either. So praise is just as dangerous as nasty criticism. So you just have to do what you have to do and love doing it the way you do it.
As we wrap it up, Addison and Gwyneth, those are characters that have been created through the fertile fields of your imagination. You have fun doing what you do, don't you?
I do. I sit in here. If I didn't have fun, I know it's not working. But when I'm sitting here at the keyboard, and I'm especially when it's in first person, when it's the narrator of the story is telling the story from his point of view, it becomes so real to me that I can laugh out loud when he says something funny. I can be moved to tears when the character is. And people who live in the house and walk by the open door to my office might sometimes think I should be institutionalized, sitting in here alone, crying and laughing and whatnot. But yeah, I love it, and it's a great blessing to be able to do something you love and be paid for it.
Well, the New York Times says of Dean Koontz, tumbling, hallucinogenic prose, serious writers might do well to examine his technique, and he is back again with a vengeance. The book is Innocence from Dean Koontz. And he is, of course, destined for the New York Times number one best-selling position once again. Thank you, Dean.
Thank you for having me there.
My pleasure. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Linda Rodriguez McRobbie. She's an American writer, journalist living in London, and she has written about all kinds of things in her varied career. And she has a new topic called Princesses Behaving Badly. Real stories from history without the fairy tale endings. Good morning, Linda Rodriguez McRobbie.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, it's great to hear your voice, and you've written about 30 different princesses, both hereditary royalty and pretenders. This is a fascinating account of how some of these princesses, they're tough people.
It was certainly very fun and interesting to write for me, and just the huge breadth of women that I was able to include in the book was gratifying, but also just fascinating. I mean, they come from so many different backgrounds and have so many different stories, and it was fun to write.
You divide them into categories, sections, starting with warriors. Tell us about how you've divided the 30 princesses.
Well, it was a little bit difficult to do that and also sort of maintain their individuality, but we did see some kind of common themes that ran between the 30 princesses altogether. And although it was a little bit of sort of, some of them could fit in some places, some could fit in others. Warriors in particular, it was really, you know, women who kind of took up martial causes in some ways. And, you know, survivors were women who may have made choices that were controversial or questionable or perhaps not the decisions that, you know, that most people would make in order to survive. You know, and then there were women who just loved to have fun, and I had them under the partiers category and things like that. We tried to do what we could to kind of help structure the book a bit, because there are a lot of princesses in there.
There's some fascinating developments and revelations. Empress Elizabeth of the Austro-Hungarian Empire slept in an unusual way. What did she do?
Well, she had some issues. In particular, she was obsessed with her own beauty and cultivating her own beauty, and she was terrified that she would lose it. So she would do things like sleep in a mask lined with raw veal as a cure for freckles and wrinkles. She would wrap hot towels around her waist, which was terrifyingly thin, even after having had four children. It was only ever around 18 or 19 inches, and she just was terrified that it was ever going to get any bigger. So she would sleep with these hot towels around her waist in order to kind of maintain her figure. She exercised fanatically. She had really, really long hair, and and just washing that hair, brushing that hair nightly was just it was a process. It was a real process.
The book is Princesses Behaving Badly, Real Stories from History Without the Fairy Tale Endings. A princess that we don't often hear about is Napoleon Bonaparte's sister. She loved her brother, as sisters generally do, but you say she supported him in war and in exile. What about their relationship?
She certainly loved her brother. Whether or not she loved him a little bit more than most sisters do is certainly up for debate, and is something that historians have talked about for a while. She was incredibly narcissistic. She was very beautiful, for one, and she knew it very much. She knew it. But she was also, she was really a diva, and the fact that her brother was gaining so much power and so much political power and influence over, by then France when she was a teenager and well beyond by the time she was in her 20s, meant that she could sort of latch on to his star. At the same time, she really did respect and love her brother and had a lot of loyalty to him and was really one of the few people who kind of stuck by him after his downfall. At the same time, though, she was kind of a brat. I mean, she would do things like demand. She took a milk bath every night, and to preserve her beautiful skin. And on a visit to a relative who probably wasn't as wealthy as she was, she demanded this milk bath, and she said, and of course, after I get my bath, I need a shower. And the man said, "Well, I don't have the facilities for that." She said, "Oh, nothing so simple. Just put a hole through the ceiling above my bathroom and have the servants pour it in over me." And this poor guy had to do exactly that because she wasn't really a woman who would take no for an answer when it came to those sorts of things.
So she and Napoleon, her brother, Napoleon Bonaparte, not just any Napoleon, they had a sexual relationship?
It's possible. Certainly the rumors and accusations were going around at the time. The fact that she was known to be particularly promiscuous and sort of people that she was meant to have slept with or number in the dozens, if not more. And her brother was rumored to have a sort of similarly rapacious sexual appetite, so to speak. And so it's not too difficult to believe that they might have been together at some point. Now, Empress Josephine, Napoleon's wife, supposedly told another courtier that she had caught them. So there was at least that evidence. And then, of course, everybody else just gossiped. So it's not exactly historical fact, but it's a possibility.
Linda Rodriguez McRobbie is the author of Princesses Behaving Badly, another princess that we probably do know as a group a bit better, Princess Margaret, the sister of Queen Elizabeth. She's quite a gal.
Yes, she is. And I have to say, living here in London, you did find that there wasn't a ton of sympathy for her, even when she was dying. But in reading her biographies and reading some of the things that happened to her, I definitely felt bad. I mean, she was sort of caught in this weird place where people who were royalty still were very circumscribed in the things that they could do. Yet at the same time, society had changed so much that it wasn't the same as it had been even 50 or 20 years before. So she, when she was a teenager, she fell in love with a man who was in her father's employ, and they had gone through sort of a number of hoops to try to eventually get married when she was in her 20s. And unfortunately, she was not able to. The country just wouldn't accept it. Parliament wouldn't accept it.
She had an affair with Peter Townsend.
Well, that was the man that she was originally hoping to marry, and they were unable to, owing to kind of the strange dictates of Parliament and her being in a weird kind of position of being not entirely free to make any of her own decisions. She eventually married Anthony, who was another man who was a commoner, but he wasn't divorced. So that passed. And while she was married to him, she had an affair with a man who was 20 years younger. They were both having affairs. It was the 60s, so there was a lot of sex, drugs, and rock and roll going on. You know, so she definitely earned herself a reputation at that point as kind of boozy, hedonistic. She had a Caribbean island that you know, she'd sort of retreat to fairly often. Of course, the tabloids would be running after her as much as possible. So she was really, I think, in a lot of ways, a victim of both the circumstance of being a royal and being in kind of this straitjacketed position, but also a victim of kind of the growing power of the paparazzi and of the tabloid media at the time.
Well, it's quite a ride. Princesses Behaving Badly, Real Stories from History Without the Fairy Tale Endings, from Linda Rodriguez McRobbie. Thank you, Linda, for joining us today and for sharing the real stories from your compelling book.
Well, thank you so much, and I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope that anybody else who picks it up enjoys it.
Thank you, Linda.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available online at wrkf.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.